Ave and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a podcast about the rulers of the ancient Roman Empire. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me as always is Dr. Rhiannon Evans, a lecturer in ancient Mediterranean studies at La Trobe University. This is episode XXVI, Seneca the Younger. Now, we're already familiar with Seneca as being the tutor and advisor to the Emperor Nero, but there's a lot more to this man behind one of Rome's most infamous emperors. He was a writer of tragedies, he was a Stoic philosopher, and he was one of the richest men in the Roman Empire. Here's Rhiannon Evans.
Seneca was born in 4 BCE to an equestrian family. So they're very, very wealthy, but they're not from the absolute top stratum of Roman society. So 4 BCE is during the reign of Augustus. He's firmly in power by this point. He's been princeps for 23 years. So Seneca's basically born into the imperial system. He hasn't ever known the republican system. And it kind of makes sense that he's part of that and eventually will become very close to one of the emperors.
So what do we know about his early life then?
We don't know a lot. We know he was born in Spain. His family is Roman citizens, but a Spanish family from Cordoba or Cordova, modern Spanish. But we know that he spent most of his life in Rome. He seems to have come there very young. There's a story that he was carried in one of his female relatives' arms to Rome as a baby, which may be an exaggeration. But we don't know a lot after that. We can tell that he obviously had the classical training of an elite Roman boy. He had the best education in Greek and Roman literature and oratory. He knows all of the tricks that anybody who'd been educated in that way would have. He has a great facility with words. And that he was put to politics at a fairly early age, sort of around the age of 30, he starts to get his first magistracy. So it's kind of the classical career path of a Roman boy. But we don't know a lot of the details.
But it does follow in his father's footsteps, more or less, which is also quite common for back then. His father was a rhetorician.
Yes, his father wrote what we might think of now as sort of textbooks.
Seneca the Elder, by the way.
Yes. So the Seneca we're talking about is Seneca the Younger. But his father, who's also from Spain, is Seneca the Elder. And we have two works by him called the Controversiae and the Suasoriae. And they're both about how to be an orator. And they both kind of give you examples. That's what they are. They're like textbooks with examples. How do you argue cases? And here's an example of how you do it, how you persuade someone. And these are the ways that Roman boys were trained. So it's kind of like a debating society sort of training. You might be given a topic and you just have to argue one side of it. And Seneca wrote these books for his sons. He had three sons, and he wrote it as a kind of aid to training. So this is something to help them in their careers. Mm. So we can see from what his father was interested in and that these works were popular enough to be preserved, we've still got them, that he had a very good background in this area. He seems to have absorbed that even more than his other two brothers and been able to write an enormous amount because of it.
So can we assume, and it is never safe to assume these things, that since we don't know a lot about his early life, he was quietly practicing these activities?
Well, quietly until a certain point.
When's a certain point?
Well, we first really know a lot about him when Caligula comes to power, which, remember, is in 37 CE. He seems to have had a great aptitude for rubbing people up the wrong way, for annoying them. And Caligula seems to have really hated him to the point where Caligula was intending to get rid of him. Now, we don't know why. They had some disagreement and Caligula apparently thought about having him killed. But Seneca always suffered from poor health. He actually lived a very long life and would have lived longer if he hadn't had to kill himself. But it was always in poor health. And Caligula spared him only because he assumed he was going to die soon. At this point, he would have been about 40. Yeah. So, you know, even by Roman standards, that's not that old. Apparently at death's door at that point, Caligula spared him, but Claudius didn't. When Claudius comes to power, Seneca is again on the wrong side of some kind of argument or the wrong side of some kind of power struggle. And again, we don't know the details, but this time it was Claudius's wife Messalina who took against him. And Messalina organized for him to be exiled. So in 41 CE, very shortly after Claudius comes to power, he is sent into exile on Corsica, which is not a bad place to be exiled to be honest. And the excuse made was that he'd had an affair with someone in the imperial family. So it was an adultery charge, which, like other adultery charges that we've talked about, may well be spurious. This seems to be the charge you bring forward when you want to get rid of somebody.
So Seneca, from what I know about him, he strikes me as a very intelligent man. I think it's safe to say that. Why does he even get close to the emperors? Because that seems to be the way to live a very short life.
Well, I guess it seems that way in retrospect, but it's also quite clever at the time, because if you think about it, the traditional career path for a Roman is to go through the magistracies, which Seneca is doing, and to hopefully rise to be consul. But even if you rise to be consul at this stage, that's not the supreme power that it once was, because by the time we get to Caligula and Claudius, it's becoming clear that this system is becoming ingrained and we're always going to have a princeps or an emperor. So being part of his circle is really important. You could be somebody who's respected in the Senate, but it doesn't actually guarantee that you will have real power, because the man who's wielding the real power is the emperor. So I guess in some ways, and this is why people like Suetonius and Tacitus are so bitter about these people, being a freedman who's very, very close to the emperor could in some ways give you more power than being a consul, because you've constantly got the emperor's ear. I would say that it's equally dangerous, because the freedmen often get wiped out too, particularly with Nero. It's a high-risk strategy. It gives you an awful lot of power, a lot of control, a lot of decision-making capacity, especially with a young emperor like Nero when he comes to power. But you risk a lot too. But I think that's probably only gradually becoming clear, and it's much easier for us to see that in retrospect. So I think Seneca is sort of learning to play the developing game, but it may not have been clear to him quite how dangerous that was.
So after being banished in Corsica for a while, which if that was me, I probably would have stayed there, Seneca is recalled to Rome to be the tutor of young Nero by his mother Agrippina. So I take it at this point his reputation is good enough to get him there, isn't it? What sort of duties would he have had as a tutor to the young Nero?
Well, he would have been required, I guess, to take him through the kind of study that his father had left for him, how to be a good public speaker, what you need to know in terms of ancient literature, what previous writers and orators you need to read. No doubt they read Cicero. They would have read all the greats of Greek and Roman literature like Homer and Virgil. He gets him really quite young. He gets recalled from exile in 48, which is when Nero's about 11. Nero becomes emperor 6 years later when he's 17. So he's really got the formative years there. And then Seneca still has a lot of influence over Nero for about the next 5 years, so until he's about 22. So he's got those teenage years when he's in charge. And I guess that means you could say Seneca's as much to blame as anybody for how Nero turns out, because he's the one who has educated him and advised him during that time. And when Nero becomes emperor, we're pretty sure that Seneca writes all of his speeches. This is what Tacitus in particular, I think, seems to indicate, which is perhaps not surprising because Nero's very young and he's got to suddenly be thrust into the spotlight, but is actually quite unusual for someone else to write your speeches. We think of politicians always having speech writers these days, even the ones who are good orators. But that was unusual in the ancient world. That's kind of the beginning of something new, perhaps the beginning of this trend. They don't really have very high regard for that. It's a sort of ventriloquism that isn't seen as something positive. But in the case of Nero, it's sort of seen as something necessary. And again, in hindsight, something that is quite positive, because in these 5 years when Seneca still has influence, Nero seems to do fairly well. He gives very competent speeches. He makes fairly competent decisions.
So we know from his philosophical works during that period that he denounced tyranny and found a lot of fault in the rich, but also the position of power that he had would have put him amongst all the tyrannical rich people. So what do we know about his teachings and his thoughts in that time? And was he ever thought of as a hypocrite?
We've got some of his essays, and he did indeed discuss tyranny, what it's like to be a good leader, how to be a good leader, or how to avoid being a bad leader.
Was it just don't be like Nero? Was that all that it said?
Well, the one that seems to be specifically directed to Nero is on clemency, on mercy, which a lot of people read as a kind of, he's seen the signs with Nero that he's going to be a pitiless leader, and he's trying to guide him. And yes, he was seen by some ancients as a hypocrite for both spending time with these tyrannical leaders, especially Nero, and flattering Nero and his
molding and advising.
Yeah. And also having a huge amount of money himself. He was the richest man in the world. Dio tells us 300 million sesterces in his property portfolio. Tacitus tells us that he lent money to provincials, and by that we mean kings, basically to whole provinces. After Claudius invaded Britain, he kind of got them into huge amounts of debt and then would suddenly ask for it to be repaid, which doesn't show much mercy, considering he wrote on mercy. So there does seem to be the potential for an accusation of hypocrisy there. One of my favourite bits of Seneca is one of his letters. He wrote a lot of letters to a man called Lucilius, who may or may not have existed. And they're basically about how he practices his Stoic philosophy, day-to-day life, and his thoughts as well, his thoughts on how you should be a Stoic philosopher. In one of them, he says that he's going to this very basic residence for a few days with just one slave, and he's going to live in poverty or relative poverty to prove that he can do it. And that seems to satisfy Seneca, that if he does this periodically, then he knows he can live the simple life.
With just one slave.
With just the one slave.
Just the one.
I think anybody can do it for a week. It's doing it for the rest of your life with no anticipation of ever getting out of it that's difficult. Whereas Seneca knew he could walk back to his 300 million sesterces, so it wasn't really that hard. But I love that letter because it seems entirely self-deluded, the idea that he does understand poverty and he can live that life because he's done it for a few days. There is a kind of honesty there that we can sort of see through, that he at least thinks that that is the case. He thinks he's really done it. And I also think that in other ways, Seneca is much more self-aware than we might think, that he knows that he's working with a tyrant, but he's just doing the best he can to guide him. And writing on mercy, I think, is the best example of that. That if he can get Nero to be merciful, then that's an achievement. If he can just steer him away from a potentially evil and remorseless ruler. I mean, he fails entirely and in a spectacular way, which leads to his own demise. But I think that there is an attempt to put his philosophical precepts into action. He's working within the imperial system, and he's working within that system to try to create the best case scenario.
When he's not living in poverty with only one slave, what sort of life is he living? It's a very opulent life, isn't it?
Well, we're told that he led a very extravagant lifestyle and that he had lots of beautiful objects. So Dio says he has 500 tables of citrus wood with legs of ivory, both of which would have been very expensive. And he served banquets on them. So there's this idea that he has this very luxurious property and he's living the lifestyle, which was consistently criticized through the imperial period, this having banquets, all right? So there's poetry and kind of moralizing, and Seneca moralizes about this too, about overindulging oneself. He writes a letter, which I was just reading recently, about going off to the Bay of Naples to spend time at a place called Baiae, which was sort of the Monte Carlo of the ancient world. It's where the rich and fabulous went for their holidays. And he says, again, he's sort of prevaricating a little bit. You can go there and you can preserve your morals, but it's a place where if you have a tendency for luxury to undermine you, then it will happen. You're kind of inviting it in.
We'll have a banquet on one of my citrus and ivory tables.
But I think, again, that there's sort of this idea that he can resist it. Right? Other people, because they're not Stoic philosophers, might not be up to the challenge. But he can go to these banquets and remain pristine morally. I know, it's all very convenient, isn't it?
I realise I'm undermining your favourite Roman here, but it's very much do as Seneca says, not as Seneca does.
Exactly. Yeah, if you haven't been through the education that he has provided, then you're not going to be able to withstand this. And of course, Nero is a terrible exemplum for him, if you follow that logic, because he has given Nero his education, but it doesn't work out.
So what do we know about the works of Seneca that he wrote during his life?
Well, now we know that he wrote these philosophical works, these essays, and the letters, which also deal with philosophy. And he wrote the satire against Claudius, which I think we talked about under Nero, the Apocolocontosis, about his deification, but it was a comedy. And he wrote 9 tragedies. But this has actually been controversial in the past, and some people have thought that the tragedies weren't by Seneca. And some people thought satire wasn't by Seneca, but most scholars these days do accept most of them. There's one tragedy they still think is not Seneca's. And the tragedies are mostly about Greek mythological topics, so very much like classical Greek tragedies. There's one about Oedipus. There's one about Medea. The topics that we see turning up in the tragedies of Euripides and the 5th century Greek tragedians. But they're much more kind of melodramatic with Seneca's treatment. And they have not fared well in the past. Their reputation has not been great, but lately Seneca has been kind of rehabilitated. So people have stopped just comparing them to those great Greek works, which are much more restrained by comparison. For example, in the Sophocles play of Oedipus, Oedipus's mother kills herself by hanging herself. In the Seneca play, she stabs herself in the stomach, which is much more melodramatic, much more over the top. And that has proved quite unpopular for the last couple of centuries. Seneca was really popular during the Renaissance, though. His tragedies had a huge influence over people like Shakespeare, and especially people who wrote revenge tragedies, which would have had a lot of melodrama in them anyway. These tragedies are worth reading both for their literary merit, but also as a kind of reflection of what's going on in the Neronian court. There's lots of pretense, lots of putting on a mask. There is a lot of hypocrisy. There is a lot of pretending that you're agreeing with the emperor going on. So they're very useful as a sort of reflection of that. For a long time, people thought the tragedies weren't performable, that they were just read out, like dramatic readings. More recently, that has been disproven. Most scholars of Senecan tragedy now say it's perfectly performable. There's no problem with it at all. That's just been a kind of prejudice against Seneca. And there have been very successful performances of Seneca's tragedies.
As I said before, it's quite dangerous being this close to the center of power. So when does it all fall apart for Seneca?
In 62 CE, he had decided to retire. We get the impression that Nero wasn't too happy with this, though, that Seneca's trying to back out of a situation that seems clear to him he can't control anymore.
Pretty clear, yeah.
So he goes off to live his private life. In 65 CE, and we covered this in the Nero podcasts, so you can go back and listen to that at more length, but it's the Pisonian conspiracy. There's a conspiracy against Nero which fails, and the fallout from it is huge. Large numbers of people are executed or told they have to kill themselves, and Seneca is one of those who's implicated. We have no idea whether he was involved at all. If he's trying to withdraw from this, then I would say probably not. But it doesn't matter. He's caught up in it. His nephew, who's a renowned and very young poet called Lucan, is also caught up in it and has to kill himself at the age of 25. There's a kind of wiping out of the great literary figures of the age from this conspiracy. Seneca, at least, is considerably older. Okay, so he's at least 67 by this point, despite the poor health he's managed to make it to that age. And the description of his death that Tacitus gives us towards the end of the Annals as we have it is very dramatic. He dies as a Stoic. He dies in a very restrained way. And it's a description worth reading. Not that a description of a suicide is ever wonderful, but it's a wonderful picture of self-restraint, and that Seneca, right up until the end, is in some sense true to his philosophy.
he commits suicide by bleeding out, essentially, and it takes a very long time to happen.
It's very long and painful in the description by Tacitus.
And he tells his wife not to do the same thing.
She tries to do it, but she's bandaged up and is preserved.
Tell me, what is he remembered as? Is he remembered as a writer? Is he remembered as a philosopher? Is he remembered as all of these things?
His reputation has gone up and down. And as I mentioned, it was at its height in the Renaissance. And now it's sort of coming back again, particularly because he sort of talked about how to live your everyday life, even though Stoicism is potentially quite a harsh philosophy to follow, because we think of it as being primarily about depriving yourself of things. Seneca is not a great example of that. But he does write in a very thoughtful way about how you can stay true to these principles, even if you are the richest man in the world. And I think people are starting to recuperate Seneca and not just see him as derivative, both in his tragedy and his philosophy. There's also a brilliant statue of Seneca. It's actually a double bust. So it's what we call a herm, and it has two heads facing opposite ways attached to each other, which is in the Pergamon Museum in Berlin. Fantastic museum, which shows Seneca on one side and Socrates on the other. Now, this is from, I think, about the 3rd century CE. But that shows at that point that those two were being put together. And Socrates is obviously a great figure from the Greek world. He's sort of, you know, if you know one philosopher, you know Socrates. But the fact that he and Seneca were portrayed together there sort of puts them on the same level in that period. And indeed, I mentioned Seneca's death and the description in Tacitus. It's pretty clear in Tacitus that it's very much modeled on the death of Socrates, even though that was by poisoning, by hemlock, not by cutting his wrists and bleeding. It's very much the same kind of, let's get the group of people around and let's die a philosophical death.
That's Dr. Rhiannon Evans, lecturer in Ancient Mediterranean Studies at La Trobe University. And you've been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, you can subscribe on iTunes, and please tell your friends about it and leave us a review there. Emperors of Rome has a Facebook page, and we'd love you to come and join our community. And you can tweet both myself and Rhiannon on Twitter. Rhiannon is at Dr. Rhiannon Evans, and I'm at Nightlight Guy. This is the end of the first season of Emperors of Rome, but season 2 isn't too far away, and I hope you'll join us then for the Year of the 4 Emperors. Until then, I'm Matt Smith. You've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.